You're listening to For the People here on Route 650, sponsored by Robert's Western World, Nashville's home for traditional country music on Lower Broadway, and Tennessee Brew Works, makers of Southern Wit, Cutaway Rye IPA, and many more. That's Tennessee Brew Works, finely tuned craft beers. On a hot Tuesday night in San Antonio, a crowd is gathering at local club The Pig Pen for the weekly songwriter showcase. I'm there as a guest, and before my set, I'm introduced to Jim Chestnut. His name is familiar, but I can't say why. A few minutes of talking reveals Chestnut's history as a Nashville recording artist signed to Acuff Rose in the late 1970s. The contract brought a record deal with a few singles tasting the Billboard charts. But a changing business landscape, along with Chestnut's own missteps, led to his leaving the music business altogether. Nearly 35 years later, the now retired Jim Chestnut has self-released 5 additional records, rediscovering his passion for music and putting his experience to work, helping to foster others. We caught up with Jim in San Antonio for a conversation.
I'm originally from Midland, Texas. I grew up out there in West Texas in the First United Methodist Church, and I think my mother spotted some sort of innate interest that I might have when I was a small child, and beginning in the first grade, she made sure that I was exposed to music through piano lessons, and I took piano for 6 or 8 years. You can't tell it now the way I play, but one of my first piano teacher discovered in me that I wasn't a very good sight reader, but I had a good ear for music, and so beginning in about the fourth grade, she started teaching me music theory so that I could learn to enjoy the music I was playing or play the music I enjoyed. And I think by the time I got to the sixth grade, I probably had the equivalent of the first semester of college music theory or something. And it really gave me a good foundation for exploring my musical interests. And then through middle school, I sang in church choirs, and in high school, I managed to pass French in high school because I led the French class choir for the teacher, and kind of skated by on that. Didn't know if it was going to pass until graduation night, but I don't think she wanted to see any more of me, and so therefore, anyway, I was one of two boys in the class, and so I got to essentially develop an all-girls choir when I was a junior or senior in high school, probably senior. And the first college I went to unsuccessfully was McMurray College in Abilene, Texas, now known as McMurray University. It was a Methodist school. And I sort of hung around people who in folk groups and so forth and played a lot in the dorm rooms and just kind of learning the basics of guitar at that point, although I didn't own one. And I dropped out of school, went back to work in construction, and took about 4 months of construction in hot weather in the summertime in Midland. I decided I wasn't going to do that anymore, and so I enrolled in school at a community college in Odessa, which is 20 miles from Midland. And I discovered a couple of things. Girls, I guess, would be on the first top of the list, and I eventually married a girl from Odessa. Also found the campus radio station. I got very interested in radio. Got on a scholarship, became the student station manager for a couple of years. Fell in with a folk choir, kind of like the New Christie Minstrels, but it was formed by a guy by the name of Dick Bowles. And the name of the group was very clever, the WD Singers, Walter Dixon. Dan Blocker had been a student of the drummer teacher, instructor there at Odessa College, only she had taught at Sol Ross University in Alpine, and he was a student of hers, and they remained close for all that time, and he came back with Lauren Green to Odessa a couple of years in a row, did a dramatic reading of sorts. The whole town turned out for it and so forth. And Dan Blocker eventually lent his name to the WD Singers, and they became known as the Dan Blocker Singers. And that group moved to California. I did not go with them. I went, instead, I got married and moved to Austin to continue my education at the University of Texas in Austin. And I worked full-time at a radio station there that was block program, but it had a country section to it. And somewhere in there, I became a licensed broadcast engineer. So they'd get two for one. They got an engineer and somebody who could read. And I put myself through UT Austin for a couple of years. Did not finish at that time. Started having babies and working full-time. And my love was radio, and I was in a bunch of television classes and some theoretical stuff there that I wasn't particularly interested in. Mm-hmm. Anyway, left there and got interested in songwriting at that point, primarily because one of the guys in radio that I worked with was a guy named Arlie Duff. And Arlie had written a really popular song, a song that was popular in maybe even the 40s, but for sure 50s and 60s, a song called Y'all Come. Y'all come to see us when you can. And it's just a real neat little singable country song.
When you live in the country, everybody's your neighbor. On this one thing you can rely, they'll all come see you. I'll never leave you saying, y'all come see us by and by. Y'all come.
Y'all come.
Y'all come.
Y'all come.
Y'all come see us when you can. Y'all come.
Y'all come.
He made a gazillion dollars off that song, and I kind of got inspired to start writing songs after knowing him. While in San Angelo, I was singing part-time wherever I could, and a radio station manager named Benny Bellamy heard me sing, and he said, hey, I want to introduce you to a guy who's a manager at Holiday Inn, and he's moving to Dallas, and they've got a club in that Holiday Inn up there, and I'd like him to hear you sing. So he put the two of us together. His name was Mike Harrell. And I got my first professional singing job in Dallas, Texas in January of 1970, working for Mike Harrell. He introduced me to another fellow named Lance McFadden, who had a number of Holiday Inns in East Texas. And I worked that circuit first by myself, and then my first wife learned to play drums, and we played as a duo for a number of years. Met Rodney Crowell in Nacogdoches, Texas, at Stephen F. Austin University. Lance McFadden, the owner of the Holiday Inn in Lufkin, where I was working at the time, said, I'd like for you to play as a duo, and I know a guy who's looking for work. Go over and talk to him. And, you know, he agreed he'd pay more money. And so I went over and I met Rodney. And I was walking up to his dorm, and I saw him sitting on the front steps playing his guitar and singing with a guy named Donovan Cowart. And they were best buds, and I guess still are to this day. I could tell from 100 feet away that this guy was something special. He had that Paul McCartney kind of feel to him, you know. He was just the real deal. And Rodney played with us, taught my wife, my first wife, how to play drums.
You're listening to For the People here on Route 650, sponsored by Robert's Western World and Tennessee Brew Works.
We moved off to Garland, Texas, and I'd been writing quite a bit by that time, and had built a four-track studio in my home, and took some demos to California and got turned down there, but not really turned down. They were kind of, now Jimmy Webb's dad was a guy named Bob Webb. He worked at MGM, and he listened to the demos all the way through every song and gave a fair critique of each song, which I accepted. And he said, but I think you really will have better luck in Nashville. So this was about 1974, 5, somewhere here. Well, on my third trip to Nashville in 76, I think it was, I walked through the door at Acuff Rose Music Publishing, which at the time was one of two big publishers in Nashville. Tree was the other one. And they invited me in and listened to 10 songs and stopped the tape and said, "What do you want?" And I told them, they said, "Okay, let's do it." So I got signed by today's standards. I mean, I don't know of any story that unfolds like that, culminated with my signing to Acuff Rose and their record division, which was Hickory Records. And that was distributed by three different companies while I was there. MGM was first, ABC was second, and MCA was third. And that contract was a three-year contract. And at the end of that contract, I went out on my own and was signed through Curb Records in California. I was signed to United Artists and Liberty. 10 Billboard singles. Neither one of my two albums charted. And the Billboard single that did the best was an original tune of mine called "Let's Take the Time to Fall in Love Again."
Somehow it's hard to remember just when we began to drift apart. Just awoke one day to find that we had lost that special spark. It's not too late to start again, to feel once more the special glow that lovers feel when they're together, the feeling that we used to know. Let's take the time to fall in love again. Bring back the magic of our holding hands. Bring back the years when we were best of friends. Let's take the time to fall in love again. Maybe we took from each other more than we were willing to give. We've got the time to heal the harm done, get back on the track and start to live. Let's take the time to fall in love again.
In those days, the performing rights organizations did a better job of surveying or sampling all the radio markets than they do now. My understanding is now that it's mostly automated and it's mostly major markets. And I know some small market broadcasters that play my stuff now, and they tell me they haven't filled out a log or had anybody call them for anything in 2 or 3 years. It penalizes the developing artists. I don't necessarily call myself a developing artist because I'm not operating under a delusion at my age of 73 that I'm going to have a giant career. But I would like to earn the royalties off of the music because the stations are paying BMI and ASCAP and CSAT for use of music. They're just not, nobody's asking them what they're playing, to speak
right,
of.
Right.
My agent at the time was a guy named Bob Neal, who was running William Morris agency at the time. And he got me a meeting with one of the owners of Tree. I don't know if it was Jack Stapp or Buddy Killen, but one of the two. And at that time in my life, I was just psychologically spent. I didn't handle that interview very well. He was trying to give me some constructive criticism. He liked the way I wrote, but he didn't like the tone and suggested I come over to Tree and work with a group of writers to become a more positive person. Well, I just got all upset with that and thought that was kind of dumb. And I was, if you ever look up in the dictionary, ego run amok, it's going to have my picture in it because I would be a perfect illustration of that in those days. But he was right. I was very bitter. My marriage was on the rocks. I was a very serious drunk in those days. And I just let the business eat me up. You know, when you quit singing in the shower, metaphorically, you got a problem. And I had become so enamored with the business of music, I ran off and left the soul of music, at least my own soul. And so even though, despite the contracts and the William Morris affiliation and all that, my career in those Nashville years was limited. So I decided to quit one day and surrendered all the contracts, and I was so pissed off that nobody called me to talk me out of it. it's kind of like the old barbershop. You finish getting a haircut, and then the barber behind you says, "Next!" And six other people are waiting there to get their haircut. Today, it's a lot different because I'm finding that you just like you are certainly aware of this. You just do such a fine job of it. But it's a do-it-yourself industry. And if you generate enough social media traffic and support, then some major might be interested in you bringing them, your audience that you've built up. And I don't know if that's the way it should be. I just think that's the way it is. I think that's the lazy way. And based on what I hear in mainstream country radio right now, I don't think there's an innovative brain in a suit, in an office, anywhere that makes creative decisions that are good for radio or that are good for country music. Melody is restricted. It's restricted to a five-note or four-note scale or even a single note. It's all become a rhythmic kind of punctuated expression of a rhythm using the human voice as a rhythm instrument. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a little bit of that goes a long way with me. I mean, I can be in a nightclub or something and someone with a good groove can come up and you know, it's got a good patter to it or pattern to it. And I can get into that, but I don't want to hear any more songs about drinking beer in my pickup truck and taking a girl on a date in a tractor. I don't want to hear that crap. It's not the human story. If country music is anything, it is a great canvas for musically painting the human story. I've been very lucky. I started a little production business here when I moved here in 82. I didn't know that I couldn't do certain things, and therefore I did them. I was around at a very good time when technology made it possible for folks like you and me to buy recording equipment that would do a decent job in a bedroom or a garage or something like that. And so with this production business, I had several advertising accounts that paid me a monthly retainer. Got a contract to produce a magazine for the Texas Wildlife Association, and I did that for a couple of months shy of 20 years before I retired from that. And I started making music again with that equipment.
On an early autumn day, the freshness of a breeze brought the morning. And the sun come rising up, shining down on leaves that fell like golden snow. And the mystery of it all made the problems of the day seem unimportant. Well, that Oklahoma morning put Oklahoma sunshine in my soul.
There ain't nothing like an Oklahoma morning, nothing like it when you're feeling low. It warms up your mind and your body, it puts Oklahoma sunshine in your soul.
I approach music differently now. I am very audience focused. You know, do I want to add this song to my repertoire, and who's that going to appeal to, and how is it going to affect the people that I perform for? And I was floating along there for a couple more albums, and I had re-recorded a song that Charlie Pride recorded of mine. I re-recorded it for album number 3 and released it as a single, and it's just straight ahead country. Mm-hmm. And we charted it. I mean, we charted it in a couple of different places, and I think it went to, I don't know, it was maybe a top 10 record in the New Music Weekly or something. And I said, okay, thank you, God, for telling me what to do. Keep it country. So I got rejuvenated after I retired and got my sons out of college, and everything sort of settled down in that regard. And now it's a full-time deal with me, and I'm a cancer survivor. I got cancer diagnosis last year, and went through some months of treatment and so forth. And during that time, I decided I was going to do things differently after this. I was going to try to use that experience to perhaps assist other cancer survivors and patients in some way by sharing my story with them, my musical story and my attitude and so forth with the cancer treatment. And it's given me a renewed sense of purpose for music. And I feel so privileged that I've now got a sense of calling, if you will, that gives me something to believe in and do until I can't. And I'm here to tell you I'm happier now than I've ever been.
May all your days be good ones, and all your thoughts be too. May all things that happen be the best for you. Some days seem to be perfect, everything goes your way. Others at times.
Once again, that's Jim Chestnut. You've been listening to For the People, presented by WSM, sponsored by Robert's Western World, Nashville's home for traditional country music on Lower Broadway, and Tennessee Brew Works, makers of Southern Wit, Cutaway Rye IPA, and many more. That's Tennessee Brew Works, finely tuned craft beers.